Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
And good Friday morning, everyone. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix, along with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Stay with us. Coming up later this hour, we'll mark the first anniversary of the Zika virus being declared an emergency. And also, why is Chef Chris Bianco such a big fan of Phoenix? All that coming up later this hour. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Arizona and California cases and those of seven other states, has been a punching bag for years, especially for conservatives. During his State of the State address last month, Governor Doug Ducey mentioned the need for Arizona to be moved out of the Ninth Circuit. And on Thursday, legislation backed by Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake was introduced to move Arizona and five other states into a newly created 12th Circuit. Carl Tobias, University of Richmond law professor, says the push to change the Ninth Circuit was somewhat silent over the past 8 years.
That hasn't really been a live issue since the Bush years, but it has been for the last three or four decades. Especially Republican senators, and especially from the Ninth Circuit, have argued strenuously for splitting the court because it's too large, they don't like its decisions, and any number of other arguments that have been made. But it was pretty moribund, of course, when Obama was in the White House, because Democrats tend to oppose the split, and he would have vetoed any legislation that went forward.
The new legislation may get some traction thanks to a Republican being in the White House and the GOP holding majorities in the House and Senate. And joining me to talk about the current condition of the Ninth Circuit is Ross Todd, Bureau Chief for The Recorder and Law.com. Ross, it's been a court with a shortage of judges and what many have considered a progressive bent. Does that accurately describe what the court is like?
There are four open seats on the court right now. 18 of the current 25 active judges were appointed by Democratic presidents. In the past, it's been known as a liberal outlier, but after 8 years of George W. Bush appointees, followed by 8 years of appointments by President Obama, who tended to appoint judges that were much more towards the center left than the judges they were replacing, it isn't quite the outlier that it once was. I covered the year before last. The court was actually upheld more often at the Supreme Court than it was overturned, which in the past never would have been the case.
Most often it is those on the conservative side who will cite the fact that it's overturned so often, the fact that it leans to the left. That seems to be one of the reasons. Now, another reason that's come up more recently has to do with the total caseload. Have people who are practically involved in the court expressed concern about the size of the caseload?
It has always been among the busiest of the appellate courts in the country. Its geographic makeup, having nine states, state Supreme Courts, as well as the federal courts of all those courts flow into the Ninth Circuit caseload, affects that. Just by its very nature, anytime a seat comes open on this court, it's declared a judicial emergency by the administrative office of the courts. That means that there's 700 adjusted filings per panel in technical terms. It just means that it's a very busy court and always has been.
Just in terms of the logic of numbers, the fact that California's on it, does it make this circuit in some ways just huge and to some too huge?
Yeah, you look at the percentage of the U.S. population that this court oversees the cases of, and that's indeed the case. It oversees the legal appeals of a whole lot of criminal cases, a whole lot of immigration cases, all the civil and commercial disputes that ended up being appealed all the way up to the Ninth Circuit.
There's been renewed call now for breaking up the Ninth Circuit, and because as a Republican president and Republicans hold majorities in the House and Senate, there are some people who actually think there may be momentum for this. If it were to happen, logistically, would this be kind of a nightmare for a while, potentially, as far as figuring out which goes where and whatnot?
Definitely. Definitely. It's administratively speaking, it runs about as well as it can, as unwieldy as it might be. Any sort of institutional change of an institution this big inserts a level of chaos that at least the folks within the institution itself would be worried about. And I know there is a pretty collegial bunch. These folks, by and large, like getting together, enjoy the intellectual jousting that they do with each other and with the folks who come before them in oral argument. They might miss the variety that they get in terms of the caseload being so geographically and subject matter diverse that they currently get in the current makeup of the court.
Has anyone commented about, now that there's renewed talk about this, does anyone that you cover, have they talked about whether they think it's interesting, a concern, anything like that?
They knew it was coming. Anytime you get a Republican majority in both bodies of Congress, there's a renewed call for this. It's interesting that it comes at a time when the court is more in line with the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court, that it might be the most serious of these calls. It's no longer the outlier that it once was. And with President Trump poised to appoint people to fill the four openings, it could come even more politically imbalanced. If you do the number counting, that would make it 18 Democratic appointees and 11 Republican appointees on the court, on the active bench. So at a time when it could be becoming less the Ninth Circus, as folks like to call it, it's likely more likely to be split. It's an interesting conundrum.
Ross Todd is Bureau Chief for The Recorder and Law.com.
Since President Trump said he would withhold federal funds from cities that are so-called sanctuary cities, several large cities around the country, like San Francisco, have become more emboldened in their pro-immigrant positions. San Francisco recently filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over that executive order, arguing that the order is an invasion of San Francisco's sovereignty.
At the same time, the city of Phoenix has found itself in an interesting spot. Mayor Greg Stanton made a strong statement against President Trump's position on immigration and said he wouldn't allow the Phoenix Police Department to become a mass deportation force. But both immigrant rights groups and the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association have come at him from both sides on this.
And I'm joined now by Vivian Ho, a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, who's been covering that city's resolution to stay a sanctuary city. Good morning, Vivian.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So let's start by talking about what it means to be a sanctuary city exactly. How are people defining this?
So San Francisco's been a sanctuary city since 1989. Essentially what this means is that city employees cannot use city resources and are discouraged from helping federal immigration agents in detaining anybody of questionable immigration status. That means that city employees will not look up somebody's status. They will not hold or detain anybody in custody for federal agents to come and get. And, you know, this has been in place since 1989. In 2013, it was strengthened with the Due Process for All ordinance, which pertains to jails. And it's been going on for quite some time.
So when our mayor here made a statement in opposition to this executive order from the president, he's gotten a lot of pushback from one of our major law enforcement associations, accusing him of forcing officers to sort of knowingly break the law. Have law enforcement groups responded to the executive order in San Francisco differently?
Actually, yeah, they responded quite opposite than that. San Francisco has pretty much embraced the sanctuary city policy for some time. And earlier this week, our police chief and our sheriff and our mayor sent a letter to the Department of Homeland Security, essentially saying that they will not be enforcing federal law, that there's case law supporting them and preventing them from enforcing federal law, and that it's better for public safety if people of all statuses feel comfortable going to law enforcement for help.
Right. That talking about that bond between the community and law enforcement, that trust.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, that's basically the basis behind a lot of the sanctuary city policy. You know, it's to the theory behind it in San Francisco is that it will actually help public safety because it will allow people, no matter what your immigration status is, to seek help from police, to seek to report crimes, to come forward as witnesses, to send their children to public schools, and to get medical help.
Right. So also, while our mayor here in Phoenix has said that we won't turn the city police force into a deportation force, he's also made it clear that Phoenix is not a sanctuary city because he says it doesn't fall within the law. And from what you've seen in San Francisco, do you think a city can satisfy both of these things? Can sanctuary cities also follow federal law in this way?
That's kind of an odd line to take. You know, when it's not set policy, it takes the risk of falling into a gray area. As set policy, like for example, in San Francisco, there became a situation in December 2015 where a man who was a victim of a car theft, he went to the police for help and he ended up in federal custody because of his immigration status. Hmm. The police had since come forward and said that that was a mistake, that never should have happened. But if this sanctuary city policy had not been in place, it's a gray area. They could technically say, you know, we're following federal law at this point, but because it is in law that our local city ordinance says you cannot do this, you know, they have to come forward and say, yeah, we're sorry, it never should have happened.
Right. Well, Vivian Ho with the San Francisco Chronicle, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And another executive order signed by the president last week temporarily blocks travel from 7 mostly Muslim countries to the U.S. The effects of that ban are felt around Arizona. And as we mentioned earlier, this afternoon a march in Tempe will respond to President Trump's executive orders aimed at refugees and immigrants. And in Tucson, members of the group Indivisible Southern Arizona plan to meet with Senator Flake's staff to urge the senator not to vote for any cabinet appointment or bill until the ban is reversed.
In the meantime, those affected by the ban are trying to figure out what to do. At Arizona State University, there are 183 students currently enrolled who are from the 7 countries listed, and 9,500 more international students at the school. Earlier this week, ASU sent emails to all of those students expressing their support, and last night, the school held a Know Your Rights forum for students who may be affected by the refugee ban. And to tell us more about that, I'm joined by Victoria Ames. She's the Assistant Dean of Legal Projects at ASU Sandra Day O'Connor School of Law and the President of the Arizona Legal Center. So, Victoria, tell us what happened at this forum last night. What did you hear from students?
We had a great turnout last night. We have about 190 students that are affected by this. And the students who were there expressed a lot of caution and concern because they didn't understand what was happening. And so there were many questions about how the executive order would affect their student visas, their residency visas, their ability to apply for extensions to stay here in the United States when their visas expired, if they were able to convert their visas as they had originally planned to work after graduation. And so those questions were addressed by our panel.
And what could you tell them?
We were able to tell them a number of things. Certainly, our panel members who have various backgrounds in immigration law, visa mm-hmm. law, deportation, removal, and criminal law in this aspect with immigration, were able to address their questions by letting them know that even though they're here on visas, everyone here in the United States has constitutional rights to invoke their privileges here in the U.S. They're able to not answer questions if they're asked. We gave out red cards last night, mm-hmm. which allows foreigners to be able to hand those to the police or other people who are inquiring about their status and let them know that they're not obligated to answer questions or provide documentation, and that they're allowed to talk to a lawyer before they answer any questions or provide any documentation. They were also told that there is some uncertainty about what's going to happen with our visa status. Unfortunately, not all of their questions could be answered because the executive orders now, as of last night, was only 6 days old, and so things change not only daily but hourly. And so we're going to be able to post updates on our website to let them know as we learn new information or as the courts or others chime in as to what they believe these orders mean or how they're being interpreted. We'll be able to provide them some updates.
Right, right. And what prompted this for the School of Law in particular? Were you getting lots of questions from students in this situation?
We were. The students who attend the university had been asking about their status and their ability to continuing their education. As you know, we're heading up to the summer break. Students have ideas about staying for work or traveling back home and returning this fall for studies, and they weren't sure whether that would be a safe thing to do. They were told last night that anybody who is here on a visa should not travel. It's safer to not travel until we understand what's going on, because we don't know if they'll be able to come back in.
Right. They could end up being stuck at an airport in limbo.
They could.
What kind of concerns did you hear from students? Was there a lot of anger or fear in the room?
Actually, it was a very calm presentation. The students were well-spoken. They were thoughtful. They had their concerns were written out often on sheets of paper. They had gathered questions from their colleagues who could not attend because they were either in classes or not able to travel. Most of their concerns revolved around not really understanding what was going on. There's a lot of unclarity in this area. The executive order is new and has been interpreted in different ways, and I think simply understanding what it means and how it impacts them was their greatest concern.
Right, right. And there, like you said, there is a lot of confusion right now. We don't exactly know how long this might last for certain countries or what the next steps might be. But what can ASU as a university do other than sort of say, this is what the law says right now?
Well, that was the initial step, was to have the university say, this is the law right now, and this is how we understand it is currently being interpreted, although stay tuned, that changes frequently. But one of the things the university is committed to do is we are working with the Arizona Legal Center that's housed at the College of Law downtown, and we are encouraging anyone who believes they're affected by this to call the Legal Center and ask for an appointment with one of our volunteer lawyers.
All right. Victoria Ames with ASU Sandra Day O'Connor School of Law. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
President Trump's executive order on immigration does more than put in place plans to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. It also calls for greatly expanding deportations, which would require a lot of help from local officials across the country, though some have publicly said they will refuse to do this. Daniel Gonzalez covers immigration for the Arizona Republic, and he's been following this story, and he joins me now. And Daniel, despite the backlash from some, it seems like there are other local law enforcement agencies that are willing to do this.
Basically, when presidential candidate Donald Trump was campaigning, he talked about creating a massive deportation force. And what's obvious now that he is president is what he's talking about is taking, you know, what existing resources are there with ICE and expanding their immigration enforcement capabilities by teaming up with local and state police, much the same way that President Obama did during the early years of his presidency. Mm-hmm. And there are police departments and jurisdictions that feel like this is a problem, that especially undocumented immigrants who commit serious crimes are falling through the cracks, that they're coming into their jails and they have no way to identify their immigration system. So while they're being charged with crimes, some folks are getting released on bond or after they fulfill their sentences because they're unaware of their immigration violations as well. And this allows them to work with ICE and put people who have committed serious crimes, turn them over to ICE so that they can be deported. So there are a lot of police agencies that are eager to come on board, but there's also a lot of police agencies that are very resistant.
Including Phoenix, right?
Well, the mayor of Phoenix has stated that he doesn't want to have the Phoenix Police Department used as part of any kind of massive deportation force. I haven't seen what the actual police chief has to say about it, and the
right.
union is pushing back on this.
Yes.
But yes, the mayor of Phoenix and lots of mayors in big cities around the country have either made statements or taken steps to create what they call sanctuary policies that limit the cooperation between local police departments and ICE. And the main concern is that these policies can undermine the community policing models. It makes people who are in the country illegally a lot less likely to cooperate with police, and that makes the overall community less safe.
So how does this executive order expand deportations compared to what was happening under President Obama?
Well, President Obama had curtailed the 287G program and then eliminated the Secure Communities program. And these are two programs that he inherited that are essentially used to enlist the cooperation of local and state police to enforce federal immigration laws. And they work in different ways, but basically the 287G program has two models. One model allows jail officials to interview and identify immigrants who are in the country illegally who have been booked into jails.
Mm-hmm.
And then the task force model trains police and sheriff deputies who work on the streets to identify and arrest immigrants who are in the country illegally as part of their normal duties. Then the Secure Communities Program is considered a much broader program, and that program basically runs the fingerprints of everybody who gets booked into jail. When the fingerprints get run through DHS databases, they're able to tell if they have any immigration violations on them. So it's a pretty broad net. It basically means anybody in the United States who gets booked into a jail, they're running an immigration check on you, and you could get turned over to ICE that way.
Daniel Gonzalez covers immigration for the Arizona Republic.
This is the show on 91.5. I'm Steve, along with Lauren and Mark.
Archaeologists think they found some clues as to what led to the demise of the Mayan civilization. The University of Arizona led the research team at a site in Guatemala. Takeshi Inomata is a professor in the U of A School of Anthropology. And Professor, it seems like you've made a potentially significant finding here.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, we are archaeologists, so we've been doing excavations in Guatemala at the Maya site called Ceibal. And then for this paper, we were focusing on the question of classic Maya collapse in which many Maya cities were abandoned.
Before this, what were the prevailing theories as to why that civilization collapsed when it did?
Well, first thing is that we didn't quite solve the mystery and the question, but I think this is an important step. So there are various theories about why Maya abandoned these many cities. One is the climate change, like a drought, and other people say there might have been deforestation and agricultural problem. Other people say there were lots of warfare and the social problems. We don't know what the answer is, but in this study, we try to figure out how this event unfolded, and then we try to see this trajectory of those events.
How do you try to go about doing that?
We use radiocarbon dating to date events or constructions. That's a physical method to date carbons that through which you can get precise dating. Also, we do ceramic analysis and stratigraphic analysis. And then by combining those various techniques, we try to establish timeline of those events.
Well, how do you take the whens that you're getting and apply those to maybe the whys?
That's a difficult question, yes. The important thing is that many people think that the Maya collapse happened over a century. Then if you don't have clear chronology, it looks like that this social change happened very gradually. But when you have precise dating, you can see much more complex and rapid change within this process of change. So what we are seeing is that the multiple waves of political problems, then followed by some recovery, and then another big collapse, and then some recovery, and then final collapse.
So based on the speed with which things happen, does that allow you then to sort of rule in or rule out potential reasons for the collapse?
We could not clearly rule out any possibilities. We can suggest some possibilities. At least at the beginning, we see social problems, more warfare, and then that's related to initial problem. Then you have a bigger political collapse, which could be related to climate or environmental change, but at least we see this kind of pattern.
What is the significance of what you found?
So this is one of the biggest questions in Maya archaeology, why those cities were abandoned. But I think there are bigger implications. Many societies go through this period of up and downs, and even our societies, this environmental social problem, big concern. Then looking at these examples of social problems and then how people dealt with those problems gives us important implications about our own societies and other societies.
Takeshi Inomata is a professor in the School of Anthropology at the University of Arizona. The paper, based on the research about new clues on the demise of the Mayan civilization, is to be published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
It was recently announced that legendary Phoenix chef and restaurateur Chris Bianco will be teaming up with Chad Robertson of San Francisco's Tartine Bakery to open up the Row DTLA. It's a project on a grand scale with plans for a market, a cafe, a butcher shop, a brewery, and a sit-down restaurant.
Lauren, did you bury the lead? Does this mean Chris Bianco's saying bye-bye to Phoenix? That's it?
Right. Well, that's the question that this put on everyone's mind when this was announced. So this isn't Bianco's first venture outside of the Valley, but plenty of us were wondering, does this mean we might lose the guy who has been so influential in putting the Phoenix food scene on the map? So I went out to Pizzeria Bianco and met him at a table in the back of the restaurant to talk about this move.
When I opened up my first place back in 88, I didn't really have the ability to you know what I wanted my life to look. I didn't have a, I think, as good a grasp as my own mortality as I do now. I think as we get older, I think if you're a musician or a chef or a writer or maybe a journalist, it becomes more paramount to do great things. You know, I've always been big on providing transparency or being available or to the best of my ability explaining something, but also giving the reason, like, why did you do it? Why now? These are the questions I would ask myself. But I want to say this in the most humble way. It's like, you know, maybe for one of the first times in life now, you know, we are the one empowered. You know, I got to get this right. Basically, if you were younger and you said, you know, I used to dream a lot about a lot of things. And, you know, if you said, man, if I could do anything, like, what would it be? And you know, I might have had a lot of crazy different ideas. But if you ever get to a point where those things become possible, you know, where really you could do anything that you want, anywhere that you want to be, nothing was in your way, what would you do? And I think this was one of those opportunities. I would say, well, I'd want to work with people that I would truly respect. I'd want to work in an environment that had the ability to reach as many people as possible. And I want to do something that's epic and iconic.
Sounds like this is your chance, you think, to do something for your legacy.
I don't know, man. That kind of makes me a little scared, I guess, the legacy part. I don't know. I've never taken myself... I mean, I take life very seriously. I never take myself that seriously. And I understand that any success I have been really, there's so many people that are on my shoulders or on my back, pushing me, holding me up. And I guess it's a way that I guess I'll have a part of something, play a role in it. And I think that, you know, I can only equate it to, like, I guess most musicians is like to make really great music. You want to be the best musicians that you can. And then when you have a great, you said, oh my God, this song is great, and these lyrics are great. Now we have to say, are the acoustics great? Is the auditorium great? Can people park and get there? And what are the refreshments going to be like, you know, to keep them company? So I think this opportunity is one that is totality of experiences, like with nothing, like you know, it's all go there, like the room sucks, but the food's good, or the food's great, but the guys are guys, you know, whatever. The guys maybe not very nice. The people aren't very friendly.
But I have to ask, though. I mean,
yeah,
you've been such a fixture in the Phoenix food scene, and Phoenix is so proud to have you, I think. Does this mean you're leaving?
You know what? It does not mean I'm leaving. I'd never say never, but I would say I've learned not to do that. But as much as never I could say, like, Phoenix is always, you know, is always home to me. I'm here. I've always been. I did a project in London 4 years ago. You know, I love that experience. It feeds me to this day. I like to think it gave me something. I gave it something. This is still my home. This might be a little political now, but I'll try not to be. But I see what's being great, you know, for Phoenix. It can only be what's great for America, and it can only be what's great for America, and only be what's great for the world. And anything that works against that, to me personally, just makes no sense. So I would look at Phoenix or Los Angeles or San Francisco or any other part of the city. I look at it as I'm doing as much as I can in as many little specks of our planet that connect all of us.
Looking at, though, like how far Phoenix's food scene has come and then jumping into the L.A. food scene, what do you think about where we are as compared to where they are and what you want to do in each place?
Well, this is a very important subject. And I think that this is something like rarely, like, we don't talk about enough, but since you do have this fuzzy device in front of me and I'm enjoying this dialogue, and since it's just you and me talking, you know, I think perception It's not everything, but it sure is a hell of a lot. You know, people asked me recently, you know, why doesn't Phoenix get the, you know, why don't we get the recognition a lot of other places get?
Right.
Well, I think we've got to take a broader perspective. And this is very serious and close to me. It would serve us best if we stopped separating the food scene from the scene itself and from our state and how people perceive us. People do get perceptions of how we are. Do they feel welcome there? Do we feel welcome there? Am I welcome there? You know, and this isn't a denial of anybody's thought. This is not a political statement. It's just, it's more of how we make other people feel, and what we say matters as much as what we do. Like, if we need you to feel welcome as a food community, to make you essentially be willing to come to our table. So that's what I see when I'm out in the world. You know, when you hear, I'm from Phoenix, I'm from Arizona, like, oh, yeah, I think I heard about that. I mean, that's, you know, the place that, you know, maybe is, you know, whatever, you know. And I'm like, well, you know what? It's not really like that. That's not my Arizona.
Yeah.
And it's not my Phoenix. I want to do all I can to make people see Arizona in the light that I do, which is a beautiful. I met my wife here, the best person in my life. My kids are born here. My family's here, my mom and dad. I'm extremely proud of it. So I'm sharing something with you that is from a sense of coming together and pride and love of this. This ain't like I'm out of here. You know, this is more about, hey, I work around the world. I want you to come here.
Sounds like we have a good spokesman for Phoenix in you.
I do my best. You know, sometimes back in the day, I used to be very defensive about Phoenix, and I still am in a way. Where they say, oh, this doesn't seem like Phoenix, and that was supposed to be the, like, they come down at Heritage Square, and they see our building, little brick building built in 1927. They go, man, this doesn't feel like Phoenix. Well, I'm saying, well, this is what Phoenix felt like before maybe people from New York or Chicago or came into it and said, you know what, we need to build Georgian houses and strip malls. Maybe this was, you know, this is what it was. And this is what, if we dust it off and preserve some of it, still is. So I'm a believer of the desert, and it's gifted me much of my life.
Well, Chris Bianco, thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you. Cheers. Bye.
Good morning. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up later this hour, how a trade dispute may affect how much guacamole you have for your Super Bowl party. Plus, I'll get on a treadmill with Liz Lerman. But first, it's time for our Friday newscap with Phil Latzman.
And good morning. In our studios for this week, we have Robert Robb, editorial columnist for the Arizona Republic. Good to have you here, Bob.
Always good to be with you.
And joining us via the border near El Paso and Juarez is Angela Cocherga, who is director of the Cronkite News Borderlands Bureau. And welcome to you, Angela. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you. Good morning.
And let's start by hearing some of the voices in the news this week.
Obviously, this process and these conclusions were not vetted. There's so many questions that, for example, it didn't filter down to our customs people.
If you've committed a felony, if you've committed a violent crime, please know that the authorities will find you, you will be put in jail, and then you will be deported. Undocumented in our country, they've always been subject to the risk of being found and deported.
This president does not like us, wants to isolate us, does not consider us full American. So that makes our mission much more difficult.
We want somebody who's principled, who's conservative, and who will not legislate from the bench. I'm convinced that Judge Neil Gorsuch is that man, and I'd be pleased to shepherd his nomination through the process.
Another very busy week. In order, we heard from Arizona's senior senator and frequent Trump critic John McCain, joining the chorus of those against the rollout of the president's travel ban edict, and then President Trump's director of media affairs, Helen Aguirre-Ferrey, defending the administration's policy. She was followed by Mohammed Riyad, who chairs the Phoenix Police Department's Arab Advisory Board, and finally, the junior senator from Arizona, with the other big news from Washington this week, the nomination of federal judge Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court by Trump, and he sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee, of course, Jeff Flake. So another crazy week in Washington. Bob, how is that reverberating here thousands of miles away?
I think people are alternately stunned, amused, and encouraged. One of the questions that resonated, I think, everywhere was whether President Trump would be different than candidate Trump. We now have the answer to that question. He's not going to be any different. He is going to govern the way that he campaigns, and that's going to be a difficult and rough adjustment for ourselves and for the world.
It's been a little nerve-wracking, I think, just having to wake up every morning and report the news to hear the things that are happening. And you wonder if it's nerve-wracking, or as we've heard on Morning Edition and other programs, people are very much in acceptance and think that the right things are happening right now.
Yeah, Bob, is it a worthwhile adjustment? I guess at this point, you've written that people sort of should have expected this based on how Trump acted during the campaign. And there are a lot of people who perhaps voted for him because they wanted some sort of shakeup. Based on how he's gone about his business so far, do you personally think there's been overreaction on certain things? Other things, maybe he deserves some of the reaction.
Yes, on both scores. I thought what has been – two things have been very noteworthy. One is stylistically, the guy's not going to change. He is going to be who he is, and that's a big adjustment. It just upsets the apple cart in terms of how all these relationships have always been conducted in the past. The second is that he is doing precisely what he said he was going to do. And the idea of a politician doing in office what he said he would do on the campaign trail is a fairly new and shocking development as well. But everything he has done is almost to a T, precisely what he said he would do. You can argue about particularly the implementation of the travel ban, but it is exactly what he said he would do. On the immigration enforcement, putting aside the refugee policy, I do think that there was very much an overreaction. He expanded slightly the priorities for deportation. He revived a couple of programs at the federal level to enlist local cooperation, which I think are not particularly controversial or unreasonable. He said he was going to begin design and engineering of the wall, but he acknowledged that actually building the wall would require subsequent appropriations from Congress. Within the executive order itself, there wasn't all that much that was controversial. There was nothing in the executive order about Mexico paying for the wall.
And there was also
that was extracurricular.
Bob, there was also nothing in that in the campaign promises that said that the president would threaten to invade Mexico to get rid of bad hombres, as he said. The Australian prime minister kicking up a firestorm there. There have been a lot of things we didn't expect.
Well, on both of those points, I mean, clearly the invade Mexico was a joke. It was a bad joke. But it was Trump being Trump. It was akin to Reagan saying in testing a mic, tell Russia the bombings will begin in 5 minutes. So that's just him being him. The confrontation with Mexico early in his administration, I think, is a diplomatic mistake. On Australia, I mean, he had to be shocked to find out that President
Obama had
agreed.
Right,
someone should have informed him before he took the call.
Let's go to the border now. Angela Kurchurga is covering in El Paso. And obviously, tell us what the reaction's been there. Is it what people have expected, or are people alarmed at the border?
Well, all along the border, it may have been a joke, but it's not funny to people. Mexico and the U.S. have a very important relationship, and it's very, very sensitive when someone says they're going to invade. And it is there is some confusion about whether he was offering to send troops on the phone call or threatening to send troops. But the bottom line is it got out there, and it's been very, very difficult as far as U.S.-Mexico relations. And we now have the president of Mexico just launching his own campaign, buy Mexican products only, and we've seen a backlash against some U.S. companies in Mexico and efforts by consumer groups with hashtags to say don't purchase products. And this couldn't come at a worse time for Arizona, which is really trying to ramp up trade with Mexico and improve and repair that relationship after some very difficult years following SB 1070. So very tough for Arizona and other border states. But of course, it doesn't mean people along the border don't want security and don't want to be safe and don't want to have a very clear border. But that relationship is very important economically. There are family ties, cultural ties, and so it's not just this is Trump being Trump. It has repercussions beyond our country in this very important relationship.
And how is it affecting families and the folks that you talk to along the border in your reporting?
Well, obviously, people who have legal documents to come back and forth are still coming back and forth. But there is this thought there, you know, there could be a backlash. People could say, I'm not going to come spend my money on the Mexican side. As it is, people are hurting because the peso is so weak right now, so they have less money to spend. As far as people coming into the country from Mexico, we know that illegal immigration is at a historic low right now. So that the people that they're building the wall to keep out are probably from other countries. We've had an influx of Central American families and children. And we do have other refugees congregating along the border, small pockets in Arizona. We have Haitians who are trying to come in. They've been told they will not get special status and will not be able to come in. That happened under the tail end of the Obama administration, and now, obviously, under President Trump, not going to happen.
So, Angela, let me start with you, and Bob, please jump in on this. Where's the responsibility of elected senators when we talk specifically about Arizona and Mexico or the U.S. and Mexico? Senator McCain, of course, has been vocal about a lot of things, the Australia thing as well. Jeff Flake is vocal about certain human rights aspects of immigration. But is it just for them to vocalize, or do senators need to take greater steps, or can they not do anything unless some legislation comes before Congress? Angela, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we have seen Arizona senators being very vocal and among Republican Congress members who are saying they're questioning the wall, whether it's worth the price and whether it will be designed to do what it really needs to do and deal with the complex issue of undocumented immigration and, of course, the law enforcement issue of drug smuggling and human trafficking. Many people, even if you talk to Border Patrol agents, the wall is a tool. It's not going to solve all the problems. So, yes, I think people are looking, and we're seeing it too, Republicans in particular, to speak up, especially those on the border who know the reality, to weigh in on this and say this is part of a solution, but we really have to look at more.
Let's touch just for a moment on the Supreme Court pick. This was the reason many Republicans who did not like Donald Trump endorsed him, because they knew he would have a chance to make a Supreme Court pick. He's done that. Neil Gorsuch, he's from Colorado. So, Rob, do you think this will be good for the West to have someone perhaps in the mold of a Sandra Day O'Connor that knows the issues out here pretty well?
Modestly at best. The issues that reach the U.S. Supreme Court tend to be constitutional in nature. Regional familiarity can inform some of the decision making, but generally it's more on abstract principles and principles of interpretation. And on that point, conservatives are heartily cheered. Neil Gorsuch is as ideal a pick to replace Scalia as one could imagine. I think he unquestionably will be confirmed. The question is whether 8 Democrats will agree not to filibuster him, so the filibuster rule does not need to be busted. If necessary, I believe it will be busted, and two of the most ardent defenders of the filibuster rule, Arizona Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake, have pretty well signaled that if necessary, they will vote to abolish the filibuster rule to confirm U.S. Supreme Court nominees.
And Democrats are going to have to pick their battles at this point, Steve.
Yeah, is that enough? Is that more chaos on the horizon then, Bob? I mean, is that one of those things?
I think abolishing the filibuster rule clarifies things, and I'm in favor of abolishing it entirely. We are seeing the way the filibuster rule bollocks up the effort by Republicans to repeal and replace Obamacare. And I think at some point, Donald Trump is going to say, enough is enough, send out an official tweet demanding that the Senate abolish the filibuster rule entirely. And it'll be interesting to see what happens.
All right, Angela, one final thing for this segment. But I spoke with Helen Aguirre-Ferre, who's a public media person I knew from Miami, who is now President Trump's director of media affairs and may very well be the highest-ranking Hispanic in the Trump administration right now.
What's the feeling from the places that you report from and the people that you talk to about the lack of Hispanic representation right now in the Trump administration?
Well, this is, since the Reagan administration, this is the first time we haven't had any Hispanics at that level. And so there is a concern that Latinos are not part of the, their voices aren't being included in the debate. But of course, the Trump administration says they're reaching out. They have other people. They don't just listen to their top level cabinet members and others, that there is a wide variety of people helping shape policy, but you look at the pictures and you see the people around the decision-making table and at the press conferences, and it's clearly not evident that it doesn't look like that's happening. Whether it's happening, we'll have to see if that plays out in policy-making decisions.
Angela Kuchurga is director of the Cronkite News Borderlands Bureau. She's with us from El Paso this morning. And Robert Robb is editorial columnist for the Arizona Republic. He's in studio with us. It's our Friday newscap. It's the show here on KJZZ along with Steve Goldstein. I'm Phil Latzman, and we'll be back in just a sec.
Good Friday morning. You're listening to the show on 91.5. If you just tuned in, it's our Friday newscap. I'm Steve with Phil.
And we're special panelists with us in the studio is Robert Robb, editorial columnist for the Arizona Republic. And on the phone with us from El Paso is Angela Kuchurga, who's director of the Cronkite News Borderlands Bureau. And here now are some more of the voices heard in the news this week.
Everyone is welcome here. No hate, no fear.
Back home, we have like bad situation. We have dictatorship. Don't allow us to like express ourselves. There is no democracy, there is nothing.
It was important to me for people to come into Phoenix to see a presence at the airport to let them know that they're welcome, that not everybody agrees with the policies of Donald Trump.
We are Syrians. I mean, tragedy is part of our life. I mean, it's not painful or sad so much anymore. America is not the first country to let Syrians down.
International education is the heart of everything. We have alumni from the University of Arizona all around the world who support us, who are leaders in other countries, and this does not bode well for the future.
And we heard from protesters against the travel ban at Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport over the weekend. One of them is Valley resident Mazi Muhammad, who came here from Sudan 2 years ago, one of the countries who's now banned from traveling to the U.S., whose citizens are banned from traveling here. And then Kerry Kenny of Gilbert, who joined the protesters, Syrian refugee Noah Abraham. And lastly, we heard from Suzanne Panferoff, associate vice president of global initiatives at the University of Arizona. So lots to get into there. Bob, first of all, the protests at Sky Harbor after the, as John McCain said, sort of the hasty, non-vetted rollout of this travel ban. Did it surprise you that there was that sort of local reaction here?
No, not really. It's clear that everyone's on tenterhooks about the Trump administration and what will happen next, and it just sort of has been building on itself as it unfolded. So what was, I thought, interesting and somewhat amusing is that it appeared to occur spontaneously, and then all the Democratic left-wing politicians started racing to airports all over the country to get out in front of the parade. So
did it remind you at all, Bob, of the reaction to SB 1070 as far as how people just weren't really sure what to do, and so they sort of just went to public places, they had gatherings, protests, whatever?
Well, I got the impression that that was more thought out and organized, and it was massive. These seemed to be genuinely spontaneous and grassroots.
Angela, how about from your perspective? You've done a lot of the reporting from the border, not necessarily at the airports, but what's it been like there just in general and in reaction to what's been happening?
Well, I think there's a lot of concern, especially when you look at the travel ban, how it affected initially so-called green card holders. Those are legal residents who've gone through all the process to become legal residents, and usually that's the next step to becoming U.S. citizens. So people thought if that can happen to them, and there are a lot of green card holders, obviously in border states, there's a real concern, can we be next? So a lot of apprehension in that respect.
Speaking of, I think the big battle that states and cities and towns and municipalities are going to fight is the sanctuary cities thing. There was big talk this week that Greg Stanton, the mayor of Phoenix, was trying to make Phoenix a sanctuary city. He says this was a plant, the idea brought up at the council. But will Phoenix, do you think, Bob, become the next sanctuary city, or is that at this point out? And there's only one that we know of, and that's South Tucson, that could possibly be affected by this in the state, right?
The term sanctuary city is pretty inexact and elastic. If you look at the executive order, what Trump did was to revive the Secure Communities program. And all the Secure Communities program requires is that local law enforcement honor a detention request from the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service for up to 48 hours. And the only threat of withholding federal funds was not complying with those requests. Now, whether cities can be compelled to do that, whether the president has authority to condition these federal grants to the local communities doing that, or whether that requires an act of Congress, whether some of them can be connected but some of them not because of the lack of nexus, those are all complicated legal issues. But that is actually what the executive order was involved. And these sanctuary cities define themselves in a variety of ways.
Some of them call it refugee-friendly.
It's all sort of a public, confused mess, whereas the executive order is much more precise and really asks for very modest cooperation from local law enforcement.
And some of the other things we've seen happen here, the Arizona legislature has weighed in on penalizing charities who help refugees settle here, and that's moving through the legislature right now. There's this fight between the state universities and the feds on the immigration ban, the U of A and ASU leaders, each reassuring international students they'll protect them from deportation. Angela, that's seems to be real defining battle lines there between government and education.
Yeah, exactly. University presidents coming out, including President Crow, very, very clear that the international relationship is important. There are the students coming in, but there are also lots of research projects going on all over the world, and so this does threaten that relationship and the perception that America is shutting its doors on some of the brightest students who are coming in to work, do research, and perhaps stay here. And as many people have already brought up this example, Steve Jobs' father was from Syria. So a very important lifeline for universities to have open. And, of course, the DACA students, we've seen universities saying we are going to protect those students as best we can, and including in-state tuition, because they are part of our student body and an important part.
Well, I hate to make light of this, but there was concern for a while that law schools were not doing quite as well. I presume with all these things and all the upset over this, we're going to see lawyers employed pretty well coming up. So.
Pretty good prediction, Steve. And one, just briefly, very briefly, Bob, if you want to, does it mean anything that Arizona wants to get out of the Ninth Circuit? This is something that's been going on for a long time. They want to form a new 12th Circuit as far as the U.S. Circuit Court, appeals courts. Does that mean anything to the average Arizonan?
It would mean a great deal. I mean, at present, if you are from the conservative perspective in a legal fight, you basically have to hope that the U.S. Supreme Court will take and reverse whatever the Ninth Circuit decides. And the U.S. Supreme Court takes up very few cases. So the drive is ideological, although there is a workload issue. It appears that this has fresh legs. I would have thought the best chance to do it was when John Kyle was in the U.S. Senate. He couldn't succeed in doing it, but it looks like there's new energy behind the effort.
We have like 2 minutes left, and we've got to like lighten things up, right? So let's talk sports for a moment here. And, just because we have to mention that Larry Fitzgerald is returning to the Cardinals for another season at age 33 after leading the NFL in receptions. Best receiver in the league, maybe one of the best guys in the NFL. You got to be happy that he's coming back to play.
Well, what struck me listening to another station, not that I would ever do that, but I was, that I always thought Steve Nash was the most popular player in Phoenix history in any sport, but people are telling me it's Larry Fitzgerald. I don't know. I was surprised.
What about you? Bob, you cast the deciding vote there.
Since I'm a basketball fan and not a Cardinal fan, sorry, Larry.
and are you headed out to the Phoenix Open this weekend at all?
I don't know that I'll make it or not, but it's a great golf tournament.
Yeah, it might be the only place in the U.S. where there's a bigger local sporting event on Super Bowl Sunday. We have the Phoenix Open. All right, well, that'll be a nice way to cap things off here. Thanks to Angela Kachurga. from Cronkite News Borderlands Unit and Robert Robb, who's editorial columnist for the Arizona Republic, from this being on this week's Friday Newscap. And it's been a pleasure, Steve.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this morning. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And with Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway, I'm Lauren Gilger. What was supposed to be a friendly first phone call between close friends went wrong earlier this week. A call between President Trump and Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull turned into an argument. Trump reportedly said he would refuse to accept 1,250 refugees being held offshore in an Australian detention center that the Obama administration had agreed to take. Here's White House press secretary Sean Spicer talking to reporters on Thursday.
The president is unbelievably disappointed in the previous administration's deal that was made and how poorly it was crafted and the threat to national security put the United States on.
Well, the angry phone call between the leaders has longtime senators like John McCain playing ambassador. McCain and other senators yesterday took it upon themselves to call the Australians to reassure them that everything is okay. But the tension is raising new questions about the conditions for detainees in these offshore centers, conditions that Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the United Nations Refugee Agency have all condemned. Kate Schutze joins me now from Brisbane, Australia. She works for Amnesty International, and she's seen these detention centers firsthand.
So I've visited Manus Island twice, and essentially people are held in quite overcrowded conditions. Both camps in Nauru and Manus are quite close to the equator, so as you can imagine, it's sweltering heat. They don't always have access to air conditioners. There's a range of health consequences of sending people to Papua New Guinea, which has malaria and multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. You know, we've also heard from Nauru, which Amnesty visited last year, that, you know, reports of sexual assault and rape of women are just going ignored by the Nauruan and Australian authorities. You know, this raises very serious questions around what's happening in these camps, why they're keeping it from scrutiny, and why the rest of the world doesn't know about it.
Most of the people in limbo here between the United States and Australia in this latest deal that we've been discussing are from Iran. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, we're talking around 2,000 people on both Manus and Nauru. They come from a range of countries, but there is a large number of Iranians. There are people from Afghanistan, Iraq, a lot of the conflict-torn countries. There's also people from Myanmar and other places throughout the region.
And what kind of conditions are they fleeing? Why are they in such dire conditions in these Pacific islands that they have to escape from somewhere else?
Oh, well, essentially, you know, people are escaping a conflict or persecution in the countries which they come from. A lot of them might be religious or ethnic minorities who some in cases are not recognized by the countries that they live in. So they'd be effectively stateless. That means they don't have the same rights as other civilians there to work, to marry, to own property, very basic rights that Americans and Australians take for granted.
And now, as the politics changes between Australia and the United States, and Donald Trump sort of mixes in refugees with the rest of his antipathy towards immigrants, maybe similar to what's going on in Australia, that limbo's now extended.
Yeah, exactly. So we're hearing the U.S. talk about extreme vetting procedures. So those who are on Manus and Nauru have already gone through extensive vetting procedures, not just on security grounds, but also in relation to their claims. You know, when we visited Manus Island and Nauru, we found it was a highly pressurized environment designed to pressure people and force them to return back to their country of origin, regardless of the risks they face there. And sadly, some people have decided to go back to their own countries in spite of the risks. And, you know, other people have taken their own lives. And we saw last year the desperation of people as two refugees set fire to themselves on Nauru. So, you know, changing these policies, essentially we've got Trump and Turnbull gambling with people's lives. And in the meantime, those people are stuck on islands in the middle of nowhere.
Kate Schutze, researching those places for Amnesty International. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Todd Zwillick at our partner, The Takeaway. For many in the U.S., a good Super Bowl party comes with a tasty Super Bowl of guacamole. But its main ingredient, the avocado, is at the center of a trade dispute between the U.S. and Mexico that's recently caused tons of the creamy fruit to be turned back at the border. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
If you've watched the Super Bowl on TV in the past few years, you're probably familiar with ads like this one.
Dave has a problem. He misses touchdowns because he loves hammering back guacamole 24/7.
Avocados from Mexico. Avocados from Mexico is the brand used to commercialize the imports. They're incredibly popular in the U.S., where 8 out of 10 avocados sold are Mexican. In fact, the U.S. is the largest importer of Mexico's avocados, and Arizona is among the top consumers.
Consumption in the Super Bowl is very high. It's about between 10 and 12% of the total consumption of the year.
So that's Ramon Paz, advisor of the Association of Producers and Exporters of Avocados from Mexico, an organization that also operates the Avocados from Mexico brand that you hear on those TV jingles. According to Mexican authorities, Mexico exported more than 700,000 tons of avocado to the U.S. in most of last year. The demand grows steadily, according to Paz. Avocados are grown throughout Mexico, but only one of the country's 32 states has an agreement to sell them to the U.S.
Michoacán.
Lino Anastasio is a cook in a small restaurant in Mexico City. He uses avocados from the state of Michoacán to prepare guacamole every day. In fact, 80% of the Mexican avocado comes from Michoacán. No wonder that Lino's kitchen, as well as the majority of restaurants in Mexico, use avocados from that state. Lino has heard rumors that Mexican avocados won't be allowed in the U.S. territory anymore under the new administration. That's because in late January, something close to that happened. A shipment from the state of Jalisco was stopped at the U.S. border in Texas. The U.S. Department of Agriculture attributed the shipment rejection to paperwork both countries had failed to sign. But Paz, the avocado lobbyist, was skeptical. He noted that the U.S.'s rejection came just as Mexico turned down a deal to import potatoes from the U.S.
The USDA decided to link the expansion of the avocado market of Mexico for Jalisco and other states with access of American potatoes to Mexico.
The USDA declined the accusations, arguing that the negotiation has nothing to do with any other commodity. Mexico only said that the avocado halt was a U.S. decision. Jalisco already exports to other countries. However, both agriculture agencies say they are working together to bring a solution. And meanwhile, the Jalisco avocados will have to wait. And for this weekend, Paz wants to assure American consumers there will be plenty of avocados from Mexico.
We expect all the fans of Patriots or Falcons to enjoy their guacamole and enjoy the Sunday.
Rodrigo Cervantes, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
Choreographer and dancer Liz Lerman could easily be described as both a mover and a shaker. Her creative ideas have been embraced around the world for decades, and about a year ago she joined ASU as a faculty member. And now ASU's Tempe Art Museum is the setting for Lerman's latest project, Minds on the Move, The Treadmill Tapes. Lerman is spending time in conversation with ASU faculty and other members of the community while she and the other person are on treadmills. So I caught up with Lerman, and yes, she was on a treadmill. I started by asking whether she'd describe the project as performance art.
You know, I don't know what to call it. I should come up with a better smash-up. Some, you know, we could ask the viewers to send in a good smash-up. It could be performance art, but there, somewhere in there is the walking and the talking and the idea that minds and imaginations are just amazing. And when they're on the move, it's pretty spectacular, I think.
There is a science to this that we're told that the more we exercise, the more our brains work right. And when we take long walks, that's the best time to get our minds working. Have you found that to be the case when you're here by yourself and when you're talking to other people?
Well, what I know about walking is that I feel grateful for walking partners that I've had over the years. And one or two people in particular that I've walked with, well, probably by now we've walked across the America at least twice. And I know that in those conversations, there's something magical about this, the way you move between family and maybe crisis, and then job, and then ideas, and then back again to the personal. And it's, I think that's one of the things I like the most about walking, is that your mind gets permeable. The other thing about walking, I don't know if this is true for everybody, but for me, there's a way you can get so internal, and you don't even really know where you are. But if you want to open out and see what else is around you, the trees or the person, or in this case, the amazing art place we're in, it also maybe it nudges you, prompts you, moves you into something, some territory that surprises you.
What's different about a conversation that maybe on the phone or you're sitting next to someone on the couch having a cup of coffee? What makes this a different kind of conversation?
It's very interesting to be on two treadmills because that's already different from when you just walk in the woods with people. There's something here about the rhythm, because when I walk with somebody here, I get on their number, whatever number they set, that's what I go on. And you can hear the little rhythm. You actually hear the sound of it. Something starts to move. And there's a moment in several of the conversations I've had here where it may be the question I'm asking, or it may just be that we've gotten into sync with each other, but somebody goes off in some new direction or a way of thinking that I find fascinating. Certain ideas about creativity theory say that if you bring two unlikely things together, you will spark something, and maybe it's a solution, but you definitely spark something. When you take a walk, you are in a constantly changing place, and those things come in and trigger you, I think.
Eye contact or no? Do you look straight ahead?
Well, this is really weird, as you and I are talking right now, because we are looking at each other, because I'm turning and talking to you while I'm walking. But with the treadmill, you know, you're used to, from if you've been done it at a gym, you kind of look forward. I find I turn, talk to the person next to me, but then the treadmill doesn't feel quite right. So there's a little bit of going back and forth. And part of that, again, is when are you internal? One of the things I'm most interested in is what is happening in people's imaginations, or this place we call imagination. Because I believe that people are creating pictures in their mind almost every second. And that if you took the time to notice what's happening up there, it's amazing. And walking contributes, as does the idea of the person. So sometimes I want to go visit, you know, what's happening in my imagination because of something that they're saying. And then I'm likely to turn away. Or you notice they're doing that. They've gone off. You can tell. People are trying to bring this memory or trying to call into focus something that's important to them. And it's that relationship, again, between imagination and now our physicality, which is, in this case, just walking.
Do you try to move the conversation a certain direction, or is it really freeform?
It's pretty freeform. One of the things I'm experimenting with this round is actually not having set questions, but trying to pay attention to what people are saying so that I can go where they go.
So long lines to walk with Liz Lerman. Are you seeking out certain people? How does that work?
For this project, I'm keeping it ASU. I kind of would love to open it. I was dreaming last night, I wish we could keep them up all summer, and I could be in here all the time and just have anybody come in and walk. Because actually, I do really think everybody is really interesting, and everybody has a story. And my own father drilled us about the amazing knowledge that everybody has from their own experience. And in a way, I'm trying to cull that. And sometimes when you walk with people you don't know, or you're just getting to know them, you can bring, you know, your knowledge to their knowledge, or their knowledge to your knowledge. And in that meeting, something important can happen for both people.
Well, is there any competition? When you're at the gym and people are on the treadmill, someone might look to the side and you're trying to have a conversation, but are they like, Liz is a famous choreographer and dancer, I'm going to crank this thing up?
I had one person not here, somewhere else, just at Harvard, who was a runner. And that was really hard. He's a dean. And he was like at it. But I've also had people who are just so excited to be talking that they start gesturing and their arms leave the thing. And I've had to reach across and catch them so they don't fall off, because they're just like so excited, which I love. Competition is interesting. I love competition. I mean, I'm a competitive person. I think competition is one of those things that, well, like most things, there's a good and there's like a flip side where it can be problematic. But you know, in a way, competition can drive you. It can get you out of bed in the morning. It can, you know, so I like it. But it's also wonderful to live in a world where you decide, you know what, for the next hour, we're not engaging in that. And it's possible to do that. One can do that both personally and in groups.
Liz Lerman, she's on a treadmill. I am not, but thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thanks a lot. Good warm up for today.
Choreographer and dancer Liz Lerman. We were talking about her new project at the ASU Art Museum, Minds on the Move, the Treadmill Tapes. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.